available to serve the members of the system. And that's all I'll touch on staff, unless there's questions. Now, our information...
I like that.
Surely.
All of the various school districts based on a single formula.
That's correct.
If one of the school districts, you talked about Rockville and Lyle County, that wouldn't affect one another, but if one school district is paying higher rates for one reason or another, he is paying higher rates. And so someone else over here in another school district that's not meeting that high standard is being subsidized by this one. I don't know if I'm explaining it right. I can keep trying until I get it.
I think we understand your question, and let me ask our actuary, Mark Johnson, to respond.
In terms of developing the rate that they pay, they're all pooled together to determine what the rate should be. However, you're absolutely correct. If, for example, one school district hired teachers at age 40 and every one of those stayed till age 65 and retired, and another school district hired teachers at age 20 and every one of those quit at age 30 and took their own money out, obviously many, many more benefits would be paid from that first school district than the other. However, they're still paying the same rate as a percentage of payroll, of each dollar of payroll. So that in that sense, the school district that has the younger employees who are not staying around to retirement is subsidizing that school district that has all the teachers that are staying around to retirement. But that's just the way that I believe it's by statute.
That's correct.
That all school districts are pooled together for experience, as are all state agencies.
Well, for some reason or other, if an administrator retires and his final average salary is way high, then the rest of them are subsidizing that person, that particular...
Yes, sir, that's correct.
I think Mr. Lieberts can help us.
Representative Bauman, Representative, that might not be true, because he might have been a school employee in some other school for 25 years where his salary was low, and that's where the subsidy would come from. The reason for this is when I started, there were 1,300 school districts in the state. Now we're down to 325, and as each school district goes through consolidation or annexation, those school employees pass from one to another. So this is the reason why we must treat them as one employer, because of consolidations, annexations, and that type of thing. But where you gain the benefit is when you go back years ago and paid very little into the system. Now that your salary is high, all the years in which you've made a low salary and paid a small amount, that's where the benefit comes from the system, because when you retire with that high salary.
The three final years.
Glad I get this thing later.
Well, one of the difficulties that cropped up late last fall is we have had some districts be a little bit more inventive than other districts, and it seems as if there were various other payments at that last year for vacation, sick leave, and things like that. And at that time, the benefit could be conceivably manipulated. We check those as closely as we can, and when a final average salary comes in for the last year that's obviously grossly distorted, we send it back to the employer and ask for justification. Most of the time, we get justification. Occasionally, it's not there, and they'll rescind it and make a correction. So we watch that so it doesn't get out of hand.
Is that abused?
Well, we thought it was, and based on a study that we did, we actually determined that we feel there is no abuse, but we found a couple of people that we had to slap on the wrist, if you will, because I don't think we had more than six, did we, Jerry?
No.
So it's something that staff watches for because it is a potential.
Is any of the legislation that's been introduced or that you've introduced to correct that problem?
Our housekeeping bill has language that...
How about the sick leave? Going to leave that just like it is?
That's not the abuse. The abuse would come in this type of a situation. A school district at the end of the calendar year would pay the employee off for the 8 months that they would have paid him during the next year to balloon that salary way out of proportion. That's the kind of abuse. Sick leave is already taken into consideration by the actuary, so that is not the abuse. The abuse is not so much in the sick leave.
I suppose we'll have an opportunity to talk about that at a later date, but that's a matter of opinion. Is that an actuarial answer that you gave me, or is that
no, that's not. Yes, that's an... That was a fact that was going on.
All right.
And I think we're staff watches for that. And then we in our housekeeping bill, we have more specific language that defines salary a little tighter that will eliminate that potential abuse. Now, moving on to our information program, in terms of the material that our members see in print, the first pamphlet is a brochure. I think, as all of you are aware, the members of the Uniformed Service Police and Fire receive a slightly higher benefit than the general service workers. And that's described briefly in that dark gray pamphlet. Members of the legislature enjoy that benefit as well. The second pamphlet is a pamphlet that we've prepared for a city or a county or a political subdivision that may be interested in joining PERS, and in there we've simply listed the ways that that they can join. The next pamphlet is probably used most, and that's our members' handbook. And in this booklet, we have tried our best to translate the very complicated and technical law into a layman's language so people have an understanding of what the benefit is that they'll receive upon their retirement. And Jerry will get into an in-depth discussion of what the current benefits are as they're currently stated. The next item is something each of you receive annually from us if you are a member of PERS, and that's the member's annual statement, and that's your statement of account that lists the money that you contributed for the last year together with the earnings, interest earnings, and that's reported each year to each member. In the last, let's say, I guess we have two items here. We have what we try to put out quarterly is our newsletter. The copy that we've enclosed this evening is our summary annual financial statement, and that has just been distributed within the last 30 days to our membership. There's a little chart there on the front in terms of where it came from and where it went. The last item under our information program is just a sample news release. This happens to be the news release that reported the lowering of the cost of funding the judge's pension plan. That cost came down rather dramatically, and that was adopted by the board at its last meeting. Now, with respect to contributions under the next tab, as I indicated earlier, presently we have the judge's fund, as indicated in the news release, we were presently paying 12.26% of payroll. That cost has been reduced to 5.3%. The state rate is currently at 11.62, and the school districts are currently contributing 12.17. Now, scheduled as of January 1 of 84, both of those rates will increase due to the benefits that we added during the 1981 session. In other words, at the conclusion of that session, our employer said, hey, we're not budgeted for that, we're right in the middle of a budget year, can't you divide that for us? And so the board divided the cost of funding those benefits into two pieces. And in January of this year, all employers had a rate increase, and next January there's a scheduled increase. Now, that could be amended by the valuation that's underway right now. We won't know that until those numbers are available at the conclusion of the study. But that's just a brief indication of the system. I would refer back to the newsletter under the information program and the pie chart on the front page. It would be this example here. The top circle there are only three sources of income to any pension plan or public pension plan. Private plans generally do not have member contributions. And as you can see here, members last year contributed over 15.5% of the total pot for a total of $135 million. Employers contributed over 30% or $265 million. And our biggest single source of income was from our investment activity. And last year, the fund earned $471 million, which was just an incredibly good year. Just sitting here, Jerry, Mark, can you help me? What was our earnings last year on a total pot? It was 15. 22% on our equity portion.
11.5.
Okay, and then we paid 11.5 on the fixed, but earned
15.5.
Okay. So last year was really a banner year, and the members of your investment council are to be highly commended for just an extraordinary job.
Well, was that partly the stock market pickup in mid-year?
Oh, surely.
It's a pretty tough year to lose money in the market.
I guess the measure would be in terms of what the market did, and then did your managers do better? Yeah. And I can't tell you just sitting here what the Dow Jones did, but my recall is that we outperformed the market is my recall. And now, the year before, we didn't do as well, but I would suggest...
How did you do compared to other state pension funds?
I think Oregon, for the last 4 or 5 years, has been... Certainly, we've always been in the top quartile. I don't know exactly how we've done. My guess is we've done substantially better. I was going to indicate that last year, when I think the market was down 4 or 5, and the Oregon Fund was only down 2. And so I think that's a very significant measure. While the market was down considerably, we were not down as well.
Yes. I believe you said you paid 11 on the fixed.
That's correct.
But you made more than that.
That's correct.
How did you do that you weren't supposed to invest the fixed amount?
Well,
you weren't supposed to gamble with that according to the statute.
Well,
so how did you make that extra?
Okay, the earnings are the earnings, and as we touched on earlier in the goals and objectives, that the board has designated that they try to put some money aside in a rainy day pot, if you will, and we're obligated to pay 7.5%. Now, they earned in excess of 15. So what they did, they gave the members the benefit of the extra earnings and paid them 11.5, but took the difference and put it in the rainy day fund, if you will.
Well, I guess I was didn't have the knowledge that I was supposed to have as far as what you're supposed to do with the fixed. And I was of the opinion that the fixed amount that by statute you're not supposed to gamble with would put in secured earnings of some kind.
Okay, and
which only earns you 11%, I believe you said.
Well, no, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, those monies are invested exactly as prescribed by statute. But what the investment council was able to do, following those very strict guidelines, is that they just had an extraordinary performance. And follow, you know, most of the fixed is in bonds, mortgages, other fixed instruments, and some cash. And certainly they've done very well in the real estate area. And in spite of those rigid guidelines, they just had extraordinary earnings.
Representative Bauman. Representative Jones, I think that this has caused a lot of confusion. Our fixed fund is not a true fixed fund. There was equities in the fixed fund also.
I guess that's what's
and
creeping
that,
out.
I think,
right.
Yes. The loss is that 35% of the overall fund may be invested in equities, in addition to whatever the individual opts to
put in. Agrees to let you
invest. But in addition to that, 35% of the overall fund may be in equities, and it was that investment in that equities of the so-called fixed fund that made the money.
Mm-hmm. Which we don't like to remember back in 73, there's a different story.
That's correct. 73 and 74 were not our best years, to be sure. Okay, if I can wrap up my portion of the presentation quickly, the last item on the agenda is a review of the bills that have been introduced this session by category only. Now, I don't intend to get into any of the content, but just to help you sort out these 50 bills by categories. These are listed in no particular order, but there are 13 bills that would extend or create new benefits that are not currently enjoyed. There are 5 bills that would amend the judges system. There are 2 bills that would merge the system into PERS, a cost of living bill, and then 2 other benefit-related bills. There are 6 bills that would amend the investment procedures. There are 2 bills that would increase the size of the retirement board. 3 bills would change our disability requirements. And then on the back side of that page, there are 10 bills that are generally referred to as restoration of service credit or otherwise referred to as buybacks. Now, there's one bill there that I've bracketed, 368. Senator Riles would not let me out of the room tonight if I didn't make it clear that is not a buyback bill. It does restore credit for a few teachers in the TRFA system from the Portland School District, but it is not a buyback bill in the traditional sense. But the other bills, the other 9, are all quote-unquote buyback provisions for various groups of people.
The 368 cost of money, though.
It still has a cost attached to it, that's correct. It's not much, but there is a price tag on it. There are 2 housekeeping bills that are there to make corrections to language the House bill corrects erroneous language, and our housekeeping bill would make necessary changes. It does not increase benefits, however, with one small exception there. There are 5 bills related to police and fire. And then the last 4 listed, there's one each. There's one that deals with the legislatively mandated costs that the pension plan would have to pay for those. Social Security, the bill with respect to Social Security is now moot because of the action taken by the Congress in December. There's one bill that would allow the Oregon Health Sciences University to go outside and establish their own pension plan. I referred to that earlier. The board is opposed to that. And the last bill is a bill that would give the same tax credit that people who retire and live in Oregon enjoy to other groups of retirees. The last document that you'll find in the book.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If the Health Sciences Center was successful in going out, then what would happen to their to the fund that they have now within the system?
Well, I guess it would depend on how they chose to treat it.
Is there any way that they could take that with them?
I guess there would be if you would allow it. The legislature would have to grant that.
Theirs already. Hmm? Representative Bowman, that benefit would be theirs already. What they have ever built up in the program is theirs. It would just be terminating their employment, and if they're vested in the program, they would continue to be vested in the program.
But still be in this program, not in another.
That's correct. They cannot move the assets here.
So then they would develop one under their new plan and have two retirement.
That's correct. They would start out with a new benefit. The boards considered that when they did their goals and objectives, and they did not find that helpful, that would splinter the benefit and not be overall, it wouldn't be to the advantage. Right now, you control the benefits. The legislature controls and sets and establishes benefits. And we don't view that as being a good concept. Now, the last item in the book are the listing of the Senate bills and the House bills separately, and probably of most significance to the committee are listed the position of the retirement board on each of the bills. The board has gone through in numerous work sessions and they've reviewed each of the bills and they've listed possibly a deferral, but generally a support or opposition to each of the bills. So if any of you would be interested to know the board's position, they're listed there. So that would conclude the overview. I would ask that Mr. Liebertz now review the benefit package as it currently exists and the benefit that our members can expect to enjoy were they to retire.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman? Present benefits under the public employees retirement system in this state are fairly high. It is also one of the reasons why we start to see the types of bills, I think, introduced as we are seeing in this session. Many years ago, when the program was not what it is today, there were many people who wanted to take their money out. It was not a good program. Now, however, when you can put it back into the program and retire with the salary that you're making today, it becomes a very interesting thing. To cite myself as an example, when I went to work for the retirement board in 1950, I think I put about $4 a month into the program. Now I put in $160 or $170 a month. But when I retire, I'm going to get the same benefit for those years where I paid $4 a month as what I'm paying now. So if I had taken my money out back in those years, it would be very interesting to me, I think. But take me about 15 seconds to pay it back if I had an opportunity. However, one of the things that really bothers me about the program is we could start to do harm to our retirement program. I think Ken alluded to the fact that it's the aim of the retirement board to keep this as one program in the entire state and let the legislature dictate to us what the benefits and everything else are going to be. When we start to see the cost factors we see, I'm finding out that in school districts, they are now saying, we will no longer run the cafeteria. This will be done by an outside agency. It can be done cheaper. The bus drivers are no longer under the school systems. They can go out, and it's pretty obvious that it's an 18% differential. We see the medical school now saying up at the Hill, to help balance the budget, what we should do is let the medical school classified employees out from under this program. And if they did go out, they would be under another program. Pretty soon, however, you could see what would happen. They would be down here testifying that they want some improvements in their particular bill, which would not be PERS. So this splintering off of groups can lead to, I think, a tremendous amount of harm in the program. If there's been an injustice done, then I think that we should try and correct it. I think that, as far as I'm concerned, I think the Senate Bill 368 for the school district employees, that was a real odd situation that happened over there with Baldwin School District, and I don't think that I would consider that, the same as Ken said, a buyback bill. What happens to employees who are members of the system? one of four things will really happen to us. One, we will either terminate our employment, or we will die, or become disabled, or we retire. But one of those four things are going to happen to each and every one of us. And if the employee...
Or we won't get reelected.
In the case of terminations, what happens is the employee receives back the monies that either he put in, or in most cases now that the employer has put in there in lieu of a pay raise, plus accumulated interest. So there is never a loss to the employee if they decide that they would like to take it out. Many other programs either do not allow you to take it out, or in many cases do not give you interest on it. But in this case, I think they're guaranteed 7.5%. Now, while they are members of the system, even if they, 4 years down the road, take their money out, during that period of time, beside getting their money back plus interest, they have other coverages. If during that period of time they happen to die and had $4,100 in their account, we would pay them $8,200. If I die today, my wife would be offered $92,000, $94,000. I have $47,000. So, you see, even before you take your money out, you have a death benefit, and you're really saying to these people, not only are we giving you interest, but we are also buying a life insurance policy for the amount of money that you have in your account. But I think that should be taken into consideration. In the case of disability, what we do, we have two types of disability. The day you become a member of this system, you are covered for disability off the job. And that disability, if it's a duty disability, and that disability is not offset by anything, SAFE benefits, Social Security, VA, long-term disability, or anything else. So if you were to hire a 21-year-old individual, put him on the payroll, and if something happened to him that particular, the first day he was under PERS, at the age of 21, we would compute a benefit, and it would be done in this manner. We would say, how much time do you have under the system? Well, he's got 2 hours, that's all he had under the system. But then we'd say, in addition, we will give you credit for the number of years that you would have had up until age 60, which is 39 years. Therefore, that individual would receive 65% of his salary. Now, you can see what would happen. It's on the job, so he's also going to receive SAFE benefits. It might be bad enough that he'll get Social Security benefits, but all of those are not offset. The disability benefits, once you have 10 years under the system, do not have to relate to the job whatsoever. So it is not unusual in this system right here that for people who become disabled to earn more money under that program than they ever took home. And if it gets to the place where they get their Social Security payment, it is not unusual for them maybe to be making 125 to 130% of gross salary under our disability provisions. I'm saying these just because, you know, this is fact. There are bills, Ken mentioned, ran through them. There are a couple of them that if they were passed, it would increase my monthly benefit by $170 a month. I won't mention which bills they are. But I think there comes a time, as an individual, that the state has to say, can we afford these types of bills? One of the problems that I see, as I said, an injustice, I think, should be corrected. But once you start to splinter off and make an exception for this group, exception for this group, then what you start to do is have the next group starting to get the same benefits as the next group, and you're just playing one angle against the other. And this is what has happened. I think there's very few bills that by themselves cost a tremendous amount of money. But when you put 13 of them together, as Ken said, I think that now that's when you really start to run into some money.
That's true.
Yes.
Matt, I'd like to ask a question. You said that there are some bills in here that could do damage to the, and that way you started out your comment, do damage to the PERS system. There are some bills that could do damage, I think that's what you said.
Yes.
All right. But none that we've passed in the past sessions of the legislature have done any damage to the system. this is the first time that we're going to pass any bills that will do damage to the system.
Representative Bowman.
If any of these pass.
Representative Simpson. Yes, this is, I'm looking at a group of them that under 2028, and that group, they would actually do harm to the system if they were passed, in my estimation.
And
yes.
None of the bills that we've passed in the past regular sessions or special sessions or any time has done any damage to the system.
No, as long as we differentiate, I think, between you say harm to the system, I think it does harm to a system when you set up a criteria for one employee and a criteria for another employee.
Well, we've done that in the past, haven't we?
Yes, and I say, Representative, I think if we continue to do this, what's happening is now the other group of people are trying to come up with the same group, and that's where you end up with the cost. We allowed people back in 1977 to buy back some time. Now it's opened the door. We last, 1981, there was a bill passed that opened the door for some people to buy back, and it was passed. As a result of that, now we have a bigger group of people who say they would like to buy back, and that group gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and that's where the cost will come to the system. I think the retirement benefit program that we have, I think, and
this to the subcommittee, that's a small subset of about 35 to 40 that could reasonably come to us. I had no real interest in any of the others. If you want to see that entire list that's in here, well, it's certainly, this is a bigger list than we, that it's in Ways and Means, it says bills and other committees. Kay can help you in terms of getting through what might be of interest to you, and if you have interest in them, don't hesitate to have them in. There's one addition to that list, and that is the omnibus buyback bill, and it's my hope that's the only one we spend time with. I'm not really interested in all the little specialty buyback bills. So if you have interest in them and can get them assigned here, we'll certainly go ahead with them. Otherwise, it'll be that list we're working on. And
is that the list that's described in the back of these?
No, that's an overall list of about 50 bills relating, you know, that the apartheid bill and the Veterans South Africa bill.
Copy of the list that is in our committee?
Should have been sent to your office yesterday. Otherwise, Kay will give you another copy plus a copy of a list of the 35 or so that are in Ways and Means. You can work that out, but it's going through the status of these bills. Otherwise, just get the cable and have them.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I was on this subcommittee last session, and I want you to know that I'm going to be extremely cautious with amendments to bills this session.
What did you do last session?
I learned a big lesson.
Great. I hope we're all cautious and
editorial comment.
I think there's a lot of there's a number of very easy housekeeping bills which we hope to go through quickly that have been reviewed by other committees. There's a number of buyback bills which I hope we only do the one, and then there's four or five other specialty bills, and beyond that I don't see us having a long intimate relationship down here.
Is one of the bills that you're planning to review the one that has to do with sex discrimination in rates for those people that are already retired?
No,
that's
not a debate.
Mr. Chairman,
that's the problem.
Well, I'm not sure we're going to get it either, but I think we ought to at least discuss it.
Great. Thank you all. Most informative night. Committee, the Ways and Means Committee will come to order. We'll start with Senate Bill 3006. And what I'd like, Kay, if you wouldn't mind, is giving us a brief introduction to the issue, and then we'll go to the people from Port.
Mr. Chairman, it will be brief on this issue. The information that I've gathered really comes from the people from Portland. The last legislature passed the essential parts of this measure to allow some funding arrangements so that the Portland School District could come to an agreement with the teachers' retirement system and allow a financing of the liability for what's now a last person's club. In other words, people that are still in the old system, new teachers go into PERS out of the Portland school system. So the bill, as you see it, amends those financing arrangements that were approved by the last legislature. Section 2, which is new, limits the liability of the teacher's retirement system to 1 year after, for any claims that might be made, to 1 year after the date of merger with PERS, or the buying into PERS for those members. The other change is on the second page, and it separates out two different kinds of financing arrangements. In the first one, that would be on line 12, in the event that the payment of the principal and interest comes from a tax levy or the tax base to comply with constitutional requirements, those levies have to be split, showing how much is from the tax base and how much is from any other levy, how much is for the paying back of those expenses. And I think Mr. Burns can explain better the reason for that. The second provision is in line 19, and that provides if the payback of whatever financing arrangement is used is made from funds other than a levy, then it doesn't have to be displayed within the levy. And that would mean if it were paid, for example, out of basic school support, other resources to the school district. I think with that brief explanation that your witness can probably elaborate.
Can that be paid out of basic school support?
That is what this would provide.
Oh, this would make it.
I think that's true.
Mr. Burns?
That seems a little bit.
Mr. Peterman? Is that gone together? Is that?
Yes.
Is that fair?
Yep.
Okay. Welcome.
Don Burns, attorney for Portland School District. Well, after the last session, we decided we'd better appear together all the time if we're going to accomplish anything. I think there's an answer to your question. The specific answer is that there's nothing in this bill that's going to permit us to pay bond principal and interest from basic school support. The bill doesn't deal with what you can do with basic school support money anyway. As a matter of existing law, you could pay bond principal and interest from basic school support. That would obviously be one of the few other source of funds the Portland School District has. But we're not seeking any change in the existing law in that area at all. Before we dive into that, I'd like to say a few words and then perhaps let Mark Peterman, the attorney for the Teachers Retirement Fund Association, address the statute of limitations part of it. And then I'll come back and explain the what we think is kind of a housekeeping revision to the funding part of it. And then we try to handle whatever questions that you might have.
Mr. Chairman, before we go on, I would, if I could, I'd like to just do to read from the bill. Representative Jones raised that question, and you say that the bill doesn't speak to that, but revenues other than the proceeds of a levy, basic school support would certainly be proceeds other than the levy, and so rather than passing over that, maybe a leading question, and that may not be part of your script, but I'd like to, because staff here, Kay, has said that made the statement that would be possible.
It says that if it's paid from another resource other than a levy, that the district doesn't then need to show or divide its levy as provided up above. I think the question of of whether or not you can pay a bond issue out of basic school support is a question that I don't have the answer to.
Let me answer your question specifically. It certainly was not our intent in what we drafted to deal with that subject. The concept was that if we had some other source of funds and it was legally permissible to use those to pay the bond principal and interest, then we didn't want to be locked into how we paid the bond principal and interest for reasons of our tax base, and we can get into that. If you'd feel more comfortable, we'd certainly be amenable to adding at the end of where it's on line 22 where it says may be paid out of such other revenues, adding if otherwise permitted by law or something. We have no intent to create some authority if none exists already.
All right.
Or, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, excuse me.
Or, if we're going that far, just say that you can't use basic school support fund for it. You say that there may be some other revenues. I don't know where a school district gets other revenues other than levies and bonds.
I'm not saying we would not look at using basic school support, assuming it was legally permissible. Now, I don't know that there's anything in the law.
That's my point. I don't want you using basic school support for that because I have helped pay for it. And that's my point.
By excluding levies, you're still allowing your tax base revenues in. That's the bulk of their monies. But I think what we need to do is have Kay find out what the status of the law is in terms of basic school support usage, and then find out whether we have to clarify it in the statute or not.
There's no intent to get. Yeah. Let me address the this part of the bill. There's nothing in here that's going to give the Portland School District one additional dollar of any kind. It's merely the question of what source of funds we are going to, from the total that we have under law today, what source of funds we are going to use to pay our bond principal and interest. Basically, we're a public entity, use all our money to educate people and pay the expenses of that, and we've got a total number of dollars to do that with, and it comes from multiple sources. So the bottom line is we're going to spend all our dollars for those publicly and constitutionally required purposes, and it's kind of it's a word game as to where you take what piece from, but let me tell you what the problem is. The reason the legislature passed our funding legislation the last session was that in no way we have authority to issue bonds or enter into any other kinds of contractual arrangements to fund our integration liability without a vote of people. The reason that was passed was that we were specifically restricted from going outside our tax base. So we weren't, by having that authority to issue bonds without a vote of the people, we were in no way going to increase any taxes. And that was the basis for passing the legislation. If we were smarter the last time, and we've learned a little bit since then, we would have drafted the initial legislation differently. The problem is that if you pay bond principal and interest out of tax proceeds, then the constitutional limit whereby your voter-approved tax base advances at 6% must exclude the bond principal and interest. We have a voter-approved tax base. And if our annual payments on the integration are somewhere in the nature of $12 million, you can see that our voter-approved amount in the tax base is not going to advance at 6%. It's going to be the voter-approved amount minus $12 million plus 6%. So that is the only reason for this piece of the legislation. It's not going to give us one additional dollar. It is not going to change our sources of funds one iota. It's just going to, if otherwise permitted under the law with respect to basic school support and whatever other sources of revenues we have, permit us to still issue bonds and use proceeds to fund integration and not require us to pay the bond principal and interest out of tax levy proceeds. Complicated issue, but hopefully that
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can clarify. What you're just saying is that you want to be allowed to use your funds in such a way that you protect your tax base.
Voter-approved tax base.
And you could conclude that you have paid off these obligations on a pay-as-you-go basis in the past. You're looking for a way to finance the whole obligation into the future for these people. And you could argue that you've been using basic school support along with all your other resources over the past years to pay those obligations on a pay-as-you-go basis. So there may be no difference, really, between what you're intending to do in terms of what pot of money you use to pay off the whole thing as you have been using to pay it off on a piecemeal basis.
Well, that's exactly right. This month, we'll sign a check for $500,000 to the Teachers Retirement Fund Association, which they immediately pay out to people. Where does the $500,000 come from? Well, it comes from basic school support. It comes from tax levy proceeds. You're exactly right. We have a total source of revenue, and we use it for the public purposes that we're obligated to use it for. And I don't think, and that's right. I'm sure that if you trace the flow of funds, it could presently come from basic school support.
So what's the effect of not passing this then?
The effect of not passing it is that when we pay the bond principal and interest amounts in the future after we integrate a $12 million, our tax base will not advance by 6% of that $12 million.
So what you're saying is, though you're saying it won't give you an extra dollar, not passing this will diminish your potential dollars down the road then?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Could you go back and explain what Section 2 does?
Well, that's Mr. Peterman's portion of the bill.
Okay.
My name is Mark Peterman. I'm the attorney for Teachers Retirement Fund Association. Last session, we reported to the legislature that we were attempting to move forward on an agreement to integrate TRFA into PERS. The school district and TRFA have now reached such an agreement. We have proposed an agreement to PERS, which the district and TRFA are in agreement on, and we are currently in that process, and therefore we feel we're very close to the actual merger. As part of our agreement, we felt that it was important to, once the merger occurs, to complete the TRFA merger as soon as possible. We are trying to avoid, if anything, any claims arise out of this merger, either by TRFA against the school district, the school district against TRFA, or the TRFA members against TRFA and or the school district, we want them brought forth quickly so that we know about them and can then, if litigation is necessary, then we'll go ahead and litigate. We're not anticipating any, but we want to get the merger cleaned up as soon as possible. For that reason, we felt it was appropriate to come to the legislature and ask that if any of these claims are to be raised, they be raised within 1 year after the date that the merger occurs. And that after that year, if no claims are raised, then we know that the merger has been completed. No one else is going to raise a lawsuit. No one else is going to have the ability to complain. And our board of trustees can resign and TRFA can be folded up. So that's the sole purpose of that, of Section 2. And we would have asked for a shorter period of time, but we do feel that it's necessary for some period of time to pass so that everyone's aware of what has occurred.
Mark, it will not take legislation to allow that merger, is that correct?
No, it will not take legislation to it. Well,
the legislation that's pending that we'll get to next week, I guess, deals with credit for years of service.
Oh, no, that legislation is not required for merger.
No. The people continuously in service in TRFA, when you do the switch, will get credit. We'll just pick up as if there's been no change, is that correct?
That's correct.
You have a substantial unfunded liability, don't you?
The school district has a substantial unfunded liability.
School district, not the fund. We learned last night in our introduction to PERS is that the school districts are taken as a unit, not on an individual basis. how does that, the financial liability, are you spreading that to other districts in this merger, or is that still over
in fact, Portland? PERS has made it, well, we've never attempted to do that, and PERS has made it very clear to us that, that even if we wanted to do that, we're not going to be able to do that. What's happening is that unfunded liability will be calculated and subject, and PERS will have to agree that that is how much is unfunded. The district then will have to come up with the excess monies to pay that over to PERS, either by a lump sum payment or by a
note or something. How much are we talking about?
Well, I hesitate to say it. We do have a preliminary report that shows the figure is about $147 million.
Is that the projected time out in the future, or would that be the lump sum?
No, that is the present value of the unfunded liability as of December 31, 1982. Taken into account is the fact that the Portland School District, when it pays the 12.75% employer contribution rate, will be helping to pay off the existing unfunding, to the extent there is any, in PERS. So it doesn't have anything to do with future contributions.
Yeah.
I might say one thing. One of the changes, after the last session, we got the funding legislation. We were admonished by Representative Katz to go out and get this thing done. Lots of things have happened. We have got a Internal Revenue Service private letter ruling saying portion of our bonds will be tax exempt. We have got a judgment in the United States Tax Court saying the balance of them will be tax exempt. We entered into a contract with the Teachers Retirement Fund Association so that we now have a contract obligation together to proceed toward integration on a certain set of terms. One of those terms is that our contract is contingent upon the one-year statute of limitations provision being passed. If that doesn't happen, technically we don't have a deal. Now, that doesn't mean we might not do something different if it didn't pass. But that's a part of our contract obligation at the moment, and that's why we're here with TRFA in support of them.
You're not saying without that limitation, the deal is going to fall apart. You're not going that far. You're just going to say there's going to have to be some renegotiation without that limitation. Is that right?
Well, it's a TRFA desired provision. We support it because it's a part of the contract. So it would be a question to TRFA as to what they would want to do if it didn't pass.
I see. Okay.
Let me address that, Representative Bowman. We believe that it's necessary because otherwise we don't know what claims are hanging around and for how many years they're hanging around. Therefore, we feel it unwise to disband our Board of Trustees, or we don't know how much money to reserve for potential lawsuits. The other point, I guess I should point out, the merger has to be approved by TRFA membership. So assuming that it is approved, it seems unlikely to me that there will be any lawsuits.
Mark, what kind of timeline until this merger? Are we talking about months or?
We're hoping months. PERS is currently reviewing our proposal. We are aware of two concerns that they have. We're not aware of any others, and they, of course, can address that. Assuming that we can iron out those differences within the next month, then it has to go back to the teachers to vote on, so that would take a month or two, and then back to PERB. So I would say four months.
I would think it would be
4 or 5 months.
This fall. The deal with the statute of limitations is it's like any economic transaction that happens on a date. You've got to place a value on it. To the extent it's held open for a period of time, 6 years, for example, you've got to place a value on that and try to deal with it. And it's just much easier to deal with a shorter period.
Okay. When is the effective implementation of your half of the bill, Section 3.
It's got emergency clause on it.
I know, but realistically, when is it going to start hurting you? This year, next year?
It only starts hurting as soon as we start paying bond principal and interest out of tax levy proceeds. So if integration happened in October and we'd issued our bonds and It would be whenever the first bond payment would be due, probably a year.
Realistically, it doesn't affect you until a year after that, does it, until you start wanting to use your 6% on the paper?
Well, that's right.
Okay. Well, to begin with, there's no need for an emergency clause in this bill, as I can see.
For the statute of limitations bill, part of it, there might be.
If you can make a case that this is for the immediate preservation of the peace, health, public health, and safety of the people of Oregon, I'll eat it, but it seems to me if you aren't going to be doing it to the fall anyway, this will be effective in the fall. Unless there's a legal problem I'm not aware of not having it in effect on the date of your merger. Minor point.
I would think that the statute of limitations should be in effect before we agree to merge. Well, no, that's not true.
But if it's passed and signed.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, it should be no problem.
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, what I'd like to do is, Don, if you can work with Kay to clarify what funds are available and the potential impacts.
Mr. Chairman, that's what I want to listen to.
Yeah. It doesn't seem there's any problem with that first part.
It kind of sticks in my mind that basic school support money is restricted as to how you use it. And I don't have any problem with them paying their own bills up there out of their district.
So much more fun when you pay it for us, then.
I know that.
Okay.
But
so
the question we'll look into is what resources would be available to pay these various kinds of agreements, bonds, notes, contracts.
Right, absolutely.
And what we want that is structured as tightly as possible. Okay, is there anybody else to testify on 33,006? Great, thank you for coming down. We'll get this on again next week. Close the hearing on 3,006 and let's go with 114 next, and Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Robert Smith, Director of the State Executive Department. I'm here recommending or representing Governor Teal on Senate Bill 114, as amended in the Senate Committee on Commerce, Banking, and Public Finance. That bill, as amended, has not been engrossed, so there's two pieces of paper you want to look at there. As you'll recall, all members on this committee, of course, were with us last summer during our second budget rebalancing special session. One of the ways that the necessary reductions in our spending level was accomplished is by reducing by 6% virtually all employees in state government who were in agencies financed wholly, in part, directly or indirectly by the general fund. And there were various ways this required agreements with the unions, and there were just every conceivable kind of variation on the theme. The net result always was a reduction in the annual salary that was to be received from July 1st, 82 through June 30th, 83, for those affected employees. At that special session, there was a very intense concern about the loss of retirement benefits by those persons. Of course, it was an unpopular thing. Nobody likes to have less, but fine. But then also, those persons who would take that pay cut would be paying for their entire natural life if they happened to be retiring at a time in which that fiscal year was calculated, was used in their final average calculation. An attempt was made informally to get that special session to accept a bill that would hold harmless for retirement purposes those individuals. And remember, at that time, we were encouraging senior state employees to retire early as part of the budget savings. It reduced the number of layoffs. So we did not want to encourage people to hang on another year or two, just from a management standpoint. And the decision was made not to accept such a bill in the special session. That was our first, I think it was a one day, or wasn't it, in June? Yes. That was the first successful one day. Budget rebalancing. Oh, the court said one bill.
And that was the budget unbalancing.
Yes. Well, that's another story, Mr. Chairman. There was general consensus that yes, such a bill, and the governor made a public statement that he would see that such a bill was introduced. Senate Bill 114 is that bill. The amendments that you have already adopted by that Senate committee I've mentioned, in essence, do some technical work that was necessary to expand the window into 1987. That looks like a very wide window. In fact, it is not. It is because of the way we must have the last calendar year's salary, so someone that retired in October 86, and people do retire not just at the end of a calendar year, you wouldn't be using any of 1986 as their final year's work. And anybody who retires through January 1, 87, conceivably could be using some part of that 82-83 fiscal year. What this bill says is, one, what you will get in your retirement benefits if some period of time in 82-83 was used and you did take a pay cut during that time, your retirement benefits will be calculated as though you had not taken the pay cut. And that will work out for if the individual is using all of that 12-month period for that portion of the final average of the highest 3 years, you'll get a credit for roughly 6% more than he actually received in gross pay. Now, there is a difference. The amendments in here that were added by the Senate were to explicitly include academics, and they all received differing amounts as part of that pay cut. They differed among the various institutions, and whether they are 9-month or 12-month academic appointments. And the retirement system has received a copy of a document